You're listening to BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, it's The Bigger Picture. It's Meera Sivasodhi, and recycle your furniture, grow your own flowers without pesticides, and when all of this gets tedious, fill your swimming pool with salt water and buy a solar-powered watch. The list goes on and on. To what extent can we sustain and lead an eco-friendly life? Joining us today are Wild Asia advisor Tosu May and Steve McCoy, Green Drinks KL initiator, founder and principal of Counterpoint, a consultancy firm providing support services on sustainability. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Steve, you have mentioned in the past that we live in a world which is best illustrated by an exponential curve. Could you elaborate? What did you mean by that?
What I meant was we basically live in the age of the exponential curve. So various, if you look at various indicators like population, the number of mobile phones, the number of McDonald's restaurants, you name it, it's generally an exponential curve that we're looking at. And that kind of data needs looking at, because in the end, exponential curves can't going on increasing exponentially. Something's going to happen. So we either manage it and do something about it, or it'll collapse.
How do you feel we should best manage it? I mean, it's easier said than done.
It is incredibly easy to say, and it's actually incredibly very difficult to do. But that's the kind of challenge that we're facing. We need to look at virtually everything we need to do. One of the things I often groan inwardly, or sometimes outwardly, is when I'm wheeled on, whenever there's an environmental or green or eco subject that needs talking about. And actually, this is not really an environmental problem. It is an everything problem. We need to look at everything we do as human beings living on this planet, and then kind of fix things so that we're able to live within planetary limits, because we only have one planet. And that actually makes it the most interesting, exciting time to be alive ever, because we get to change and reinvent everything. So it's incredibly interesting.
Don't you get tired of, talking about it and talking about it? Is that what keeps you going?
Well, I mean, I intellectually find this the most interesting thing. This is really the only topic where you can look into and talk about everything to anybody. It's relevant to any sector, business sector, NGO sector, civil society sector, the government sector, because this is our planet. And it's going to be touch and go whether we will be able to fix things in time before we have devastating climate change, for example, or our soil goes completely bad. So that our food security is very compromised. There's problems with the oceans. There's all sorts of things. So we need to think and act and act quickly.
So, you do a lot of environmental work as well. What are your thoughts on this?
That's a tough one. I mean, first of all, while my work does touch upon sort of environmental, how to reduce a business's environmental impacts, that's as far as I want to go as to say I'm an environmentalist. Because I think when you're trying to compartmentalize people, you're sort of limiting, what people think that you can do, and you just get shoved in a, labeled and put into a, a box. And that's not necessarily good for, what Steve was trying to say. This is not just about the environment. This is about everything that we do and how everything has interrelated to, water, earth, air, everything.
Right. Let's take an example. Malaysia is the largest exporter of palm oil in the world. Mm-hmm. And you work with palm oil companies on the RSPO. Am I correct when I say it goes beyond just planting and extracting oil the sustainable way? We spoke about this just now. It goes well beyond that.
It goes well beyond. To be sustainable is not just the environment. And I think this is where a lot of people sort of get the wrong idea. When I say putting labels on things, eco-friendly, you're just thinking about sort of the ecological effects, but you sort of forget that there are people behind those labels working to produce your sustainable palm oil. Mm-hmm. So it takes into account social aspects of production. You're paying your workers well, you're not exploiting them, and you're giving them a chance to progress and not just keeping them at that low level for the rest of their working lives. Mm. So seeing things holistically, take it a step further, you have to see beyond the borders of the plantation as well, because who is going to buy your oil if with all these things in place, your oil will the cost of your oil will be more expensive than, you know, the plantation next door. So to identify sort of partners in a whole supply chain who think the way you do, and to create that link where you actually have a, you know, a more stable market for your particular oil, and that will keep the business sustainable, and that is good for you know, that, and that business is done with less impact on the environment and on the people that work on it.
Steve, you have mentioned that we currently live in a take, make and waste model. How else will businesses thrive and us people have our needs met if, you know, this is not the case?
Yeah, and that's a $1 million question. I think most sustainability professionals and other kind of NGOs or people who have actually looked at the kind of data that we need to look at realize that we can't carry on with the take, make and waste model. You know, that's a kind of economic growth model. And the economy has basically been thriving on the exploitation, and I use the word exploitation neutrally, the exploitation of natural resources and human resources. And the more you can exploit those two, the bigger your growth in economy. And this is compounded by the fact that some of the indicators that tell us that we're doing well actually don't indicate that we are actually doing well. So, for example, GDP, that drives a lot of decision making, that doesn't actually tell you that we're actually progressing as a society. But we're stuck in this economic growth model, and it's actually very hard to get out of it. Because to tamper with economic models like this, it's actually very unstable. So when the economy goes down, actually really bad things happen. When we stop consuming, people lose their jobs, children can't go to school, they might lose their houses or mortgages, and nobody wants that because that's not any kind of progress. So we can't carry on the way we're going. It's actually, we can't go back. So we need to innovate and find new things. Nobody really knows whether this is actually possible. I think it is. But what businesses need to start doing is to get away from the exploitation of human resources and natural resources. Think in terms of natural capital and human capital. So that the natural world has a value. You know, a tree has a value as a tree. It's not valueless. It doesn't, you know, it only gets on the accounting books now when you chop it down in order to build a factory or a house or make paper. We can't account for trees. So natural capital and human capital. And we're at a point where some of the planetary limits were above it. And we need to orientate the business world to restore natural capital and human capital. Businesses can't do that by themselves, so we need a whole bunch of things to happen concurrently. So one of them would be to really do some good work on indicators. The EU are looking at, well, they've had this long, well, fairly long project of looking at what they call the genuine progress index. So you don't just look at GDP. GDP just measures, well, it actually measures money. So whenever money moves, GDP goes up. So if you drive a car and you put petrol in the car, GDP goes up. If you drive a car and you have an accident, GDP goes up. If you drive a car, have an accident, go to the hospital, GDP goes up. So it's not a very good indicator to tell us where we need to be going. So work on indicators would be very important. And also we need to really think about the big questions, like what is the economy for? What is business for? And we need to do that from industry to industry, different sectors.
Only when we start counting certain things, those are the things that we find important. Yeah, so we start tracking it, we start trending it. And like you said, your earlier fact that, you know, we are living in an exponential curve, but that were only for those things that you were saying, things that we are consuming and all of those. But if you draw a different curve, for example, for a number of rivers that's been dried up over the last 10 years or 20 years, you find that
it's the opposite.
I mean, the numbers would go up, obviously, but you know, the number of healthy rivers, for example, would be going down.
Sure.
But in some sense, this is a progression, because things do get worse before they get better. So, you know, in rivers, for example, Thames, that's a very popular one. It was a dead river, but it was now brought back to life. So again, it's about managing and what are we managing? Right now, GDP is, like you said, is all we see. So that's all we measure. So that's all we care for. Put in a few more indicators so that we start thinking about those things. If we've got nothing to measure, we don't know what's happening to it. It doesn't matter to us.
Now, how far do Malaysian businesses combine profitable business with an environmental responsibility? Where do we stand in the world?
I mean, this is all still pretty new in this part of the world, primarily, I think, because we haven't been constrained by things like the Kyoto Protocol, which is climate change. So there's been less public awareness. Actually, very difficult to know where we stand, because our data is just so patchy. I think, you know, kind of my own feeling is that we don't do particularly well, but, you know, that's really not surprising. We're certainly not at the bottom of the list, and we're certainly not at the top of the list. You know, we have challenges that are peculiar to Malaysia, and that we are still a relatively young country, only 50 plus years old, and, you know, we still have a large disparity between rich people and poor people. The trouble is that when you look at trend data, which is really the important thing, I mean, metrics and what you measure on a snapshot is really neither here nor there. Mm. You know, big deal. You know, we can compare ourselves to Singapore, we can compare ourselves to Thailand, it doesn't really mean anything. The important data is the trend data. So which direction are we going? And I think we're just heading in the wrong direction. We're basically heading where all the other countries have got to already and have caused, you know, this massive, huge, but incredibly interesting and stimulating problem that we have. And I think we just need to know that. The trouble is whether we'd be able to innovate in a way that we need to as a fairly young country and steer ourselves away from the path that everybody's, you know, we're just like lemmings. Everybody's heading towards the end of the cliff, and it's just very difficult to turn things around.
If you have just joined us, I'm speaking to Toh Soo Mei of Wild Asia and Steve McCoy of Green Drinks KL, and we're talking about creativity and innovation in eco-friendly living. When we come back, we'll find out the right direction we should go into on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
You're listening to BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, it's The Bigger Picture, and I'm Mira Sivasodhi. With us today are Toh Soo Mei of Wild Asia and Steve McCoy of Green Ring Scale, and we're talking about creativity and innovation in eco-friendly living. We spoke just now about moving in the right direction. Soo Mei, where can we actually start?
We can start everywhere, I think, and it has to start at every level. I mean, everybody likes to say education is a big thing, and that is true. So I think one of the things that I've been speaking to, you know, some of my friends about this, and I think understanding why we need to do things in a different way, the understanding is perhaps a bit lost. They feel that they don't feel any different about the way things are, and they don't see that, you know, their own activities or consumption activities actually affect the way their lives or the environment or the planet. They don't see it. So it's really, you know, there's so many things one can do, but it's got to be matched to sort of so many people's different desires and motivations and points of view. So that's a very, very big question that I've don't have an answer to. But I think setting examples will give people ideas. I say, oh, you can do that. That's great. Education is a big thing. I think it has to, people at all levels, from, you know, just individuals to companies, businesses, governments, they need to know that there is another viable way of doing things.
How do you feel we can teach our children to be more aware of ecological concepts? Are we doing it the right way at the moment?
You know, we do that as many different ways as there are people. I think what we talked about earlier about thinking in components and thinking in systems, that needs to change. And that, never mind about the children. Okay, we need to start learning to think in systems. And that is not intuitive for us, because we divide the world and everything in it in its component forms. So we have the government sector, we have the education sector, we have the environmental ministry, we have different countries in the world, we have work, we have leisure, and really life shouldn't be divided into these components. One of the biggest problems and the biggest challenges in sustainability is not the kind of dire immediate problems that we have, be they environment or social, but really understanding the connections and all the unintended consequences that we just don't know are happening because we don't understand and we don't think in systems. So that's a kind of a big challenge. You know, how do you get government ministries to have joined up thinking and talk to each other? It's hard enough as it is because you have turf wars and egos that need to be looked after. But certainly that's one of the things we need to do. And in education, it's just very natural to have kind of, you know, arithmetic, science, geography, a bit of biology. And we need to be able to integrate all these subjects.
I mean, it goes beyond teaching them recycling, the three bins, you know. You know what I mean? That's so superficial. I remember in one of your talks, Steve, you said, how much water does it take to make coffee? And most of us would say maybe half a cup or three quarters cup, but there's more to it.
Yeah, I mean, there is the consumption of consumption, and there is the consumption that happens in production. And of course, why would we know that? You know, we don't work in a factory and understand how things are made. We just go to a shop and pick it off the shelf, and there you go. But these are some of the kind of basic things that is really very useful data. Things for us to know in order to be able to be good, responsible consumers.
But do you think it would work better if people understood these things?
I don't know. You have to ask the people.
for me, when I heard your explanation, I mean, it sort of made a lot of sense, because how many of us actually think beyond what we're actually buying?
Plastic, I mean, for me, that's one of the totally, you know, is there intelligent life on this planet kind of moments. You know, we go to whatever your chicken rice shop or your nasi lemak shop, and nasi lemak, you have the nice banana leaf, but you know, if you're into plastic, you stick the stuff in a piece of plastic to take home, which is whatever, 10, 15, 20 minutes away. You sit down, you eat it, consume it, and you throw the plastic away, and that takes tens of thousands, if not forever, to biodegrade. It's just a ridiculous thing to be doing. It is so convenient. The only, you know, we need just very clever innovation kind of people to be able to reduce our footprint, so that we don't go back to have to go camping every time we go out, you know, with your glass straw and your own cutlery and etc.
Yeah, and I think this is where businesses come in. Businesses, as we know, move faster than government. And so for the plastic problem, I mean, people want convenience, like you said. They don't want to think about, oh, what's going to happen to this when I do, you know, put it in the bin, where does it go, how does it affect life. So biodegradable plastics is just as convenient. And this is where I think the huge opportunities for businesses to come up with better, I wouldn't say perfect,
you know, alternatives.
Yeah.
Now, have we set concrete targets to meet in terms of our carbon footprint as a nation?
It depends what you mean by concrete.
Have we have any targets at all?
Well, we have. We have a target to reduce our intensity of carbon by 40% by whatever it is, 2050, I think. So that means that we reduce the carbon intensity for every unit of GDP that we increase. To me, concrete targets means that a country will say, at the moment we emit X number of tons of CO2 a year, and by the year 2050, 2100, whatever it is, we're going to be carbon neutral, or we're going to be down to zero. Now, that is a concrete target. And I think countries really need to be talking in those terms. If you're a developing country, fair enough. You know, you still need to develop, and our carbon emissions will be going up. All right, let's just take that for granted. But we need to know not how much less it's going to be growing up if we grow an X amount. We just need to know when we're going to be down to zero, or when it's going to start to go down. Because if we don't have that kind of global data, then we just don't know at all whether we will be able to head off catastrophic climate change. We just don't know. And so we're just gambling. We're just gambling with the future of not many generations in the future, but literally, you know, the children now. It's their future that we're gambling. And it's not okay. It's not okay for the politicians to be so complacent about this. If somebody tells you, and you're about to go on holiday and you get on that plane, and if somebody tells you that plane has a 50-50 chance of landing on the other side, we would not get on that plane.
Of course.
And that's where we are at with climate change and the kind of international negotiations.
There is a very large body of people who are sort of saying this is the climate change is totally natural, and technology is going to fix it.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are natural events that have occurred with global warming, not so much climate change. I mean, there's no doubt, everybody knows, we've known for many, many years, centuries now, that the effect that carbon dioxide, for example, happens with you know, sunlight coming in. There are a bunch of people who talk in terms of geoengineering. That is kind of doing something to the atmosphere, for example, to reduce this problem. And there are lots of theories about how we do that. It is very true that we know from volcanoes, for example, when there's a big volcano, the last one in Iceland wasn't big enough, unfortunately. But when you have a big volcano and it spews up stuff to the stratosphere, or one of the spheres, that is able to bring down the temperature by up to a degree and a half, maybe 2 degrees. And that's really useful, because that will buy us more time. The big danger is that the permafrost, which contains a lot of methane, if that then melts and then you have a big methane explosion, so lots of methane goes up in the atmosphere, then that's game over. So that will buy us more time. But the trouble is that, and actually you can put a relatively little stuff in the atmosphere and make a big difference in terms of temperature. The trouble is the oceans. So the oceans are getting more acidic, and you can't bioengineer the oceans. It's literally mole for mole, you know. You can't do a little thing to the oceans and you know, there are lots of ocean. I mean, there are a lot of moles there. So bioengineering won't save the problem. But some of these schemes, I think it's almost, well, I'm just guessing, okay, but it's almost inevitable that we will have some kind of atmospheric engineering, because we're just getting too close to these thresholds. And the trouble is, we don't actually know the threshold. Mm. So it's all gambling. And what's really worrying me is that when you listen to the climate scientists, they're getting more worried as time goes on. Sometimes scientists can overinflate, you know, everybody gets a bit excited and all the funding, you know, comes to researching this thing, and actually when they do all the research, it's not as bad as it was. But actually they're just getting more and more and more worried, you know, the more they realize.
Well, that's just buying us time, isn't it?
That will buy us time. I think we need time. Yeah. At the moment. At the rate we're going, we need that kind of buffer, I think.
What are you guys talking about at the Nutgraffs Found in Conversation this Sunday?
So the title is Eco-Friendly Living.
Creativity and Innovation. Yeah. Eco-Friendly Living.
Yeah, but actually we're just going to be talking about everything.
Okay.
Because that,
you're
going
to be there all day.
Well, I mean, I'm happy to talk about this, you know, till you get really, 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 really bored. So, for example, we're going to talk about, you know, the fact that there is this fatigue developing around green kind of things, or environmental protection, or climate change, or saving the planet. And we're going to explore kind of a little bit about why that is, and what we need to be doing about that. We're going to talk about the government.
Oh, yes.
And how we influence government policy makers. That'll be an interesting little question mark.
What people like us, and as well as companies, what they can do to move things along as well.
The Nutgraffs Found in Conversation this weekend is titled, as Steve and Sumi just mentioned, Creativity and Innovation in Eco-Friendly Living. It will be held this Sunday, the 26th of September, from 7 to 8:30 p.m. Do note that networking begins at 6. It will be held at Leonardo's Dining Room and Wine Loft, Jalan Bangkong Bangsa, and the three panelists will comprise Steve McCoy, our lovely Steve here, and Sumi of Wild Asia, together with Kelly Tai, the CEO of the Just Life Shop. Thank you both very much for joining us today. This is The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
BFM 89.9, The Business Station.